At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
Hello and welcome to episode 96 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's ongoing search for the myriad of reasons people play and get hooked by this endlessly fascinating game. Rod Morrie's my name, and this episode is one with a bit of a difference. It'd be fair to say that the majority of our guests on The Thing About Golf are lifelong, or at least long-term, lovers of the game. And that's a perspective that I, and I'm guessing most of you, are both familiar and comfortable with. But all of us can benefit by stepping outside our comfort zone occasionally and looking at things from a different perspective. Our guest on episode 96 is more than qualified to help us do just that with golf. Dr. Hannah Brown is a highly respected scientist who for most of her adult life gave golf no thought, except to be safe in the knowledge that she had no interest in it. In fact, if push came to shove, she was probably closer to the anti-golf camp than those in the pro-golf ranks. But all that changed when she met her now wife, a single-figure pennant player who was very much more in this podcast's demographic. To cut a long story short, Hannah is now like most of us, having fallen in love with the game, though not so much many of the cultural aspects that surround it. So why should we as golfers care? Well, there's a couple of reasons, but mainly because Hannah's is an extremely intelligent voice with some extremely interesting and sensible things to think about. And she comes from a perspective that many of us rarely encounter and certainly almost never consider. If your interest in the game extends beyond your Stableford score next time you play, I'm convinced you'll find something in this chat that will stimulate the mind. Well, the first thing we have to say, Dr. Hannah, as we... Dr. Hannah or Professor Hannah?
Just doctor's fine.
Just doctor is fine.
I am hoping for a promotion to professor very soon, but we can stick with doctor for today.
We'll go with doctor for today, and then we might update the episode later. If that comes through, you can let me know. Thank you for taking the time. Our normal jumping off point is The Thing About Golf is the title of the podcast. What's the thing about golf to you? But I don't want to start there with you because unlike most of our guests, you're not a lifelong or long-time golfer. You're sort of a late convert to the game and, in fact, started possibly indifferent, leaning towards anti-golf. Tell us what your golf experience was as a youngster, and then we'll sort of explore how you ended up here where you're actually now a lover of the game.
Yeah, look, I probably had an interesting transition into golf. I'm not sure too many would have a story like mine, but my dad was a pretty keen golfer. I don't think he was a good golfer. I don't actually know. I didn't really ever see him play, and he's long gone now, but he took my brother and I to some come and try golf lessons as really little kids. I reckon I was probably 8 and my brother was probably 6. And we stood out on the driving range as you do on a Sunday morning. It's about -5 degrees. It's foggy. There's 50 other parents bullying their kids into learning to swing a golf club. And I was hopeless, like absolutely hopeless. And it was tough because I was pretty good at most things as a kid.
So you're naturally sporty?
Yeah, I was sporty and I was gifted academically and I just was lucky. I've got a good memory and I never had to work too hard at most things, and you know, and that's very annoying. I acknowledge that as an adult, people find those things very annoying. People probably found it as annoying as a kid too. And so I stood on the range and I could not make contact with the ball. I played hockey. I was playing hockey. We were swimming. I was playing all kinds of other things. Hopeless at golf, right? And then my brother stands up there and just absolutely belts the cover off it. But so much so that he belts the cover off it and cleans up a bird on the full and just kills this thing like dead on the ground, right? And so I'm just like horrified. I'm like, oh my God, I'm never coming back to golf. I think, you know, I was 8. My brother's bawling and my dad's like, okay, it's time to go. I think it's time to go. Anyway, afterwards, my dad took us to 10-pin bowling because he thought, oh, I can erase the memory of that morning with a trip to 10-pin bowling. And my brother, flat out, he was a little competitive little nut, and he still is, and he refused to have the bumpers up, and he was like six, and he didn't hit a pin for the whole match, not a single pin. And so he scored zero. And so not only did he kill a bird in the morning with like an absolute belter of a drive, but in the afternoon he didn't hit a single pin at Tempion Golf. We still talk about it all the time. We're like, do you remember that time you killed the bird at golf? And he's like, yeah, but do you remember the time I didn't hit a single pin at Tempion Bowling?
Real mixed day.
Look, he has a set of clubs these days. He's not completely scarred by the experience. I wouldn't say he's a great golfer by any stretch. He just enjoys going out with his mates occasionally. And yeah, look, my game has barely improved since then. You know, that whole making contact with the ball, I still find that difficult. Mm-hmm.
Join the thousands, millions of the rest of us who are in the same boat, Hannah. The people they put on TV, they're not the norm, trust me. We laugh a little bit at that, but that whole way of trying to introduce a kid to the game, you can sort of see looking back, can't you, that might not have been necessarily so successful.
Nothing good about it. It was freezing. It was wet. It was muddy. There was just a whole bunch of dads yelling at their kids, hoping that they were going to be, you know, the next champion. It was just, you know, and it was probably like that was borderline off the back of Greg Norman days, right? Mm-hmm. Like this was probably the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And everybody just thought their kid was going to be a golfing legend, I thought, you know, and that's probably not the case. I mean, certainly not the case for my brother and I. We've gone on to do amazing things, but it's not golf. But, yeah, I think, you know, sport was different back then, and I think the way we approached how we got kids into things back then was pretty different too. But, you know, my dad gave up. He was a big believer of the fail fast thing. I don't think we went to another lesson. He was like, yep, no, they're not good at this. We're moving on. And that's kind of how it was. These days kids are just forced to go back to Auskick even though they're crying every week and just participate. But my dad was always looking for us to be great at something. So he probably was like, kids, that's not the one for you. Let's find another one.
That whole experience and that notion of, you know, parents, we know parents in sport are probably, that's not unique to golf in any way, shape or form, is it? We see that in all sports, quite sadly.
No.
Golf, like others, but sadly. You're now, I think we could safely say, a convert though, Hannah. So I imagine there was a big bit in between where the golf really had not much to do at all with your life. And then what happened? And how do we convert more people like you, which is the ultimate goal of what we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure that most people would take on the road travelled by me as their transition to golf, but maybe there are some keys to be learnt along the way. I mean, I met my wife, she wasn't my then wife, she was my brand new girlfriend at
that
point.
That would be really weird if you met her and she was already your wife, wouldn't it? That would be a strange relationship.
That would be unusual. I mean, I think that there are some relationships that work like that, but it was not how it worked for us. But no, I met her and like in the first 10 minutes, I reckon, of the date, she's like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I'm really interested in science. I'm like, what do you do? She's like, golf. And I was like, okay, so this has been fun. What? Golf? You know, after the experience of the bird killing event of 1990 or whenever it was, I actively never engaged with golf again. You know, it occasionally came on the TV and I was convinced that there were two sports that I didn't like and that there were two sports that I could not engage with, and that was motorsport, which I still really am not a big fan of, and
you're
golf.
About motorsport.
I can't watch either of those things on TV. They are so boring. And so when she said she was into golf, I was like, uh-huh. Like, I am so confused by this.
What a shame. And in so many other ways, you seemed nice.
Yeah, I was like, okay, this seemed to be going well, and now we've hit a stumbling block. But it was honestly, it was only maybe 2 or 3 weeks later. And for those of you not familiar with same-sex female relationships, that's basically the entire courting time. There's lots of jokes about U-hauling and what early same-sex female relationships look like. So 3 weeks in, we were probably already destined to be married, I think. But I actually went out to walk a round of golf with her. It was a beautiful day. It would have been like June or July, so unusually warm. And I got out there. I worked out how to find her. Like, she's like, oh, we'll just be on the 10th tee. I was like, the what? Anyway, I found her and her group. And then a golf cart came past with gin and tonics.
Well, hang on.
And I was sold. I was like, say what? You don't even have to hit the ball. You can just walk with a gin and tonic. I was like, okay, hang on. Someone hasn't got the PR for this quite right, because I didn't know this was a thing. And so I drank like two gin and tonics, and they laughed a lot and hit the ball. And I was like, oh, you know what? This doesn't seem all that bad. And so what? That was 2018. Still had zero desire to have a go at it myself. I was like, oh, yes. You know, I followed her around a season of Pennant in 2019.
She's a good golfer, your wife, and she's like a Pennant player in metropolitan Melbourne and now in Adelaide.
Yeah, yeah, she's a solid golfer. She can really hit the ball. She hits it a long way and she hits it well. She had a solid win yesterday at Pennant. And, yeah, so I followed a Pennant season. You know, my mum came out. We kind of, you know, I got to know the game, and I quite enjoyed having the walk. I thought, oh yeah, this doesn't look all that bad. And I got a very romantic, I think it was Valentine's Day 2020, just moved to Melbourne, and just as the pandemic was kicking off, I got a very romantic golf bag for Valentine's Day, as you do. We got married about 12 months before that, and I had said something along the lines of committing to giving golf a go in my vows. So I was always committed to this thing because she's super passionate about the game. She has worked in golf education. She has been a member of a golf club in Melbourne and in Adelaide. And, you know, she's played golf since she was little, and it's really, really important to her. And I figured it's important to her, it's important to me, so I can give it a crack. But it is not as easy as it's made to look. You know, the ball doesn't move. I was like, yeah, you know what? I played hockey. I've got this. I can do this. The ball's moving there. Turns out not so much. It was in the pandemic I kicked off my entry to golf. Probably not the time to start golfing, but in Melbourne you could just go 5 kilometres, and we were fortunate that we had a little 9-hole par 3-ish golf course around the corner. And one day I was like, right, we should give this a go. And Sam, I think Sam almost had a heart attack. She was like, say what? And I was like, let's play golf today. And I had been given this hand-me-down set of clubs from a friend of Sam's. And she was like, right. And so she capitalized on my moment of weakness during lockdown, in the first lockdown in Melbourne in early 2020. And she was like, right, today we're doing it. And so we went and had a go.
And how did that go?
You know what? I made a birdie on the second hole.
Yeah, well, now you're hooked.
Yeah, right? Of course. I was like, I mean, I made like 14 on the first hole.
Doesn't matter.
It is and I mean, for those of you, I mean, anyone who's played at the Oakley Public Course will know the first hole. I think you tee off into I think I swung three times and made some kind of contact with the ball on the third go, and it may not have been with the end of the club. It's unclear. I don't remember the first hole, but I do remember what it looked like, and it was boggy. Like the first, you kind of go off the tee block, and it's just like bog. And so you can imagine what it's like as a brand new person just hitting it into this bog and then going down into the bog and having another go. There's no run. There's nothing good. You just 5 metres forward in the bog. Yep. But I was lucky enough for Sam to say, you know what, I've heard of this cool guy and this cool thing down at the Oakley Golf Course. It's called One Club Golf, and it's run by a guy named Sandy Jamison. And you just need one club. And so I actually just had a one club that day. And it made a birdie on the second hole. I don't really remember the number on the first hole, but I'm certain it was about 14. And honestly, I never did all that much better with that on that hole than that the whole time we ever played there. But yeah, like I made a putt with my one club from off the green on the second hole, put it in the hole, and celebrated in a style which some would say was ungolf-like. One would have thought at that stage, but whatever, I was embracing my brilliance.
Yes,
and it probably took maybe 2 years for the next
birdie. That's kind of how golf works. Welcome to the game. A bunch of stuff strikes me about what you said. I want to go back to your wife. She's more typical probably of the guests that we would normally have on this show, imbued in golf, immersed in the game completely, possibly from the bulk of her life. You've had the experience, and most of us who are in golf probably don't understand what that looks like to people outside the game. This is part of golf's image or PR problem, is it not? That golfers don't realise that others don't get the game, and we don't express our feelings about the game in a way that invites others in necessarily. Talk a bit about that, because as you say, we joke about it, but that first date, when she said she's a golfer, I'm sure you had genuine misgivings. You know, you've met these people, you know what they're like.
Yeah, and I think it's not unlike like the word scientist. I think, you know, science has had a PR problem. You know, it's a space that I'm very familiar with. I trained as a scientist. I've worked science in science or science adjacent my whole career. And when you Google the term scientist, Google feeds you back a bunch of people who look like Einstein, right? Old white blokes. And I suspect if you Google golfer, although I've never done it, and hit the image button, you probably get something that looks pretty similar. It dishes you back, although women's golf is extraordinary and the PR's changed a bit, but I suspect it dishes you the same thing, heaps of blokes. And so, yeah, I don't know what I thought it was going to be like, but it's certainly, I mean, don't get me wrong, There are still a number of elements of what I thought it was going to be like in the game, but I didn't think it was something that 30-year-old women played. I didn't think it was something that 30-year-old women fully embraced. And I mean, like, it's like a cult.
Oh yeah,
like, it's a sickness. The kind of following, you know.
It's a sickness.
Sounds like, yeah.
It is a sickness, and it really. I've just done the golfer Google image thing. First picture, not surprisingly, Tiger Woods. Then we get Rory McIlroy and a bunch of other blokes, as you say. Second line, Paige Spiranek. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Paige, but very much settles on. So there you go. That kind of backs up some of the stereotypes that you would expect to find in golf, I suspect.
But I think that's also quite an interesting stereotype for women's golf too, right? It's the it is women's golf, but also it's not women's. You know, she is not women's golf. She's a small marketing part of a
huge following.
You know.
Huge following.
Yeah, massive, massive, you know, and you know, the kind of narrative that she's creating on social media, I think the kind of backlash that she faces and the kind of positivity that she generates and the kind of people that she shuts down, particularly on Twitter, I think is super impressive. But it also detracts, I think, that having to have those conversations detracts from the fact that the women playing the game are extraordinary. You know, it's Sam and I talk about it often, actually, because she's, you know, Sam's an excellent golfer. And we talk about it a lot because she tries to explain to me that the difference between her and me, you know, someone who's me borderline 40 handicap, although improving.
I was going to say coming down, no doubt. Yeah. Down to 45, yeah. I'm sure.
Oh, God, if it could get much bigger, it was much bigger. You know, and she's sitting around the 5 mark at the moment, I think. And she said the difference between me and her is basically the difference between her and the women at their best.
Yeah,
right?
maybe even and smaller. I mean, Greg Norman once said that the difference between a 20 marker and a scratch marker isn't as big as the difference between the scratch marker and the touring professional. And yeah. I think that probably quite true. Anyway, I interrupted. My apologies.
Yeah, but, you know, it's that. You know, I look at her and I'm like, holy moly. But then there's like another level. And that's what we should be talking about, those extraordinary elite athletes just absolutely getting on with it. And instead we're talking about the stuff around the edges, you know, that completely unnecessary narrative around, it's not unnecessary, but it's not about the women in sport. It's not about how good they are. It's about the fact that they're there. And that's not different than what I see in my role every day, where we're talking about women in STEM, in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, medicine, where instead of actually celebrating the amazing things that women are doing in STEM, we're still having conversations about the fact that we have diversity issues and pay inequity issues and all these other things. And that takes away from the headline narrative of the fact that these people are actually killing it. They're doing extraordinary things. And it ain't different in golf. You know, we're still, they don't have that, you know, and rightly so, we should be having a conversation that the purses aren't as big or, you know, that they are, you know, that there's a huge amount of inequity. I mean, it's how exciting to see that the women are going to play at Pebble Beach, right? But, you know, we spend too much time talking about the stuff that isn't, how good they are and how amazing they are and the shots that they're playing, and we talk about all that other stuff, and I wish we didn't have to talk so much about that other stuff, because you transition from being a I think, a tireless advocate for being a champion of change to a tired one. You know, I think the narrative gets tired and the people standing up championing for these things get tired, and that would be a shame. But, you know, you see people burn out and people get tired of having these conversations all the time. And that's when I fear we run into problems where who will fight for these things that we still need, despite the fact that we're sick of talking about it.
It's as much as a golf problem, it's probably a media problem. We had Meg McLaren on the show, who's been one of those champions for a long time. And in fact, to her own detriment, I think she would even acknowledge in many ways just the energy that she's had to devote to some of that discussion. She's pulled back from some of that now, and rightfully and understandably so. But one of the points she made, I think, goes directly to that media thing. It's just as simple as the coverage of women within the golf media itself. And we have our own media. In some ways, it's one of golf's problems. We talk to ourselves constantly, and we don't talk to anybody outside because we don't need to. We speak our own language. We have our own magazines, websites, podcasts, blogs, books, the whole thing. So that can be a problem. But she gave us the figure. She looked through one of the English golf magazines once, I think it was, and counted up all the photographs of golfers. And it was something like 4% were of women. And of those 4%, chances are a percentage of those won't be of the women playing golf, but it'll be of the women at the pro-am charity ball the previous night in evening gowns and those sort of things. It's just they're not even deliberate ways that we portray women broadly, but in sport particularly, is the same in golf. And so you're right, you get these things. When you're exactly right, the staggering ability levels of these women is extraordinary. Go out and watch some of the top women golfers. I remember watching Lydia Ko just dismantle Royal Melbourne Golf Club when she won the Australian Women's Open in the company of Mike Clayton, one of the great days of my life, and he was sort of giving the running commentary. You couldn't see golf played better. You could see the ball hit further and you could see different shots, but you couldn't see the game played any better. It's as good as golf gets. It was like watching Tiger at Royal Melbourne. And that does get you're right, somewhat overlooked. The issues around pay and those things, there's other elements at play there too, though, isn't there? Women need to earn that position too, in as much as the sport's got to be worth. You don't just say, let's give women equal pay. I think they've created a little bit of an issue with the majors in some ways for the women. The purses are now so astronomically larger than the week-to-week purses on the LPGA that there's something out of balance there that is, in the longer term, may not be. So I'm not sure that it'll drag the rest of the purses up necessarily. That's a discussion for a different time.
I mean, and there's lots of, you know, there's lots of work to do around it by everyone around golf to make sure that all of those things are resolved. And I think that that's when, you know, everybody needs to take a bit of responsibility for where things are at. You know, we're talking about, are they investing the right amount of money in developing technology specifically for women, or are they, or, you know, are women just benefiting from the benefits for blokes? You know, are we, you know, I think it's not different to the narrative that we're creating around AFLW and the change that we've seen in AFLW, this whole, well, it's got to pay for itself and it's got to do this and that. It's like, you know, I think you can make arguments anyway, but I think what you have to commit to is actually growing the game more broadly. And that it's not just for women, but it does mean that, yeah, you know what, you've got to spend some of the money earned by blokes on developing women, because otherwise it's actually never going to catch up and you're never going to have a safe and equitable space for women and let's raise it and for transgender people and for non-binary people in golf if you don't reinvest some of the funds that come from a game that has been made purely, you know, where the money's been made by blokes for a long period of time. But that isn't different to other businesses.
No, that's
and
true.
Fundamentally, golf's a business.
And you've got to create the equitable space because the LPGA is a fabulous ad for women's sport. Of all the women's professional sports, the LPGA is probably the longest running and most supportive of women. More women have made a living playing golf for a longer time than I'd imagine almost any other sport on the planet, including tennis. It's the women's sport success story, and yet the difference between there and the men, it makes it complicated issues. Obviously, you're right, but you're right. Investment in who's they? You mentioned they are they investing in who are we? Who is,
well,
is
think
they?
Everybody,
us?
I
is
think,
it us? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean it is. There is a role for the general public. I mean, if it continues to just be a conversation about us and them, you know, oh, they hitting off the red tees. Like, you know, I think it's the change has to happen everywhere, but everybody has to buy into the fact that we actually want a game that's inclusive and equitable. And I think we remain a long way away from that, you know, by making clubs really inaccessible because they're crazy expensive and because they have fences up around them. You know, by nature, you know, there's that the term exclusive is a really interesting one, and we talk about exclusive clubs and exclusive opportunities, and you know, and we use it. I think golf wants to use it in a really positive way. You know, it's, you know, it's, as you know, in the high end sense of the term
premium, exclusive.
Yeah, but fundamentally, exclusive is the opposite of inclusive, and that's a problem for a range of reasons, because at some point the money is going to run out. You know, inflation's fractionally gone down this morning, but you know, it's really high. The cost of living is extraordinary. And I guess that means that people have less money to invest in things like golf. And there will always be money, people that can afford golf, but that shouldn't be the only offering. And, you know, I have issues with the fact that only a small fraction of the population can buy into this exclusivity, and that there are limited options for a more inclusive version of the game. Because, you know, I've really grown to, we haven't really talked about it yet, but quite like it. I wouldn't say I'm having a good time, but occasionally I have a good time, and I think that's what keeps you in the game. Like, one great shot keeps you in the game, especially if someone else sees it and admires it. And why wouldn't we want to give that opportunity to everybody? You know, I really struggle with the dissonance around finding something that's good for you and that can make you feel really good and offers these great opportunities for friendship and exercise, and it's good for your brain, and yet it's only available to very rich people.
That's partly an issue about the business model of golf in Australia, is that in other parts of the Western world, not so much Scotland, where the notion of a club, the whole point of a club is to exclude, isn't it? It's to exclude those who aren't like
part
us
of the
in
club.
Whatever way, if you're not part of the club. And that's a partly a problem with the business model. Public golf is clearly the place. And those who sit in ivory towers at very exclusive golf clubs probably don't realise this. They should think about it more. Public golf is what feeds all of that ultimately. And public golf is under threat. And I wonder whether golf, as an amorphous mass, does enough to protect that. You mentioned Oakley and you mentioned Sandy. Sandy's been a guest on this show. He does amazing work with that one club. The concept is so simple, so brilliant. It, for the moment, is still... It still lives only at Oakley, as far as I know. Slowly growing, needs to grow more. That whole public golf at accessibility, it's the funnel for private golf, isn't it? Private golf per se, I have no qualms about it existing necessarily. If you want to get together and form a club and do those things, I know there are others who ideologically might disagree with that, not just in golf but with all sorts of things. I don't have a problem with that necessarily. And in some ways, the nature of the asset somewhat dictates that. Large tracts of land aren't just available to go and use. But maybe talk a bit about the importance of public golf. You touched on a couple of things. You mentioned the word sort of diversity. And I wonder, lots of people would just shrug and say, well, who cares how diverse golf is? Golf's been going fine for 500 years without worrying about diversity. Why is it important for golf to be more inclusive and diverse?
Oh, because everything's better when it's inclusive and diverse. You know, I think, and that's the thing, I think that that's the thing, one of the things that fascinates me the most about golf, and that is that it's filled with business people, and those business people acknowledge that in their businesses, diversity means money, right? You know, the more diverse your board, the better. You know, actually, the more women you have on your board, or the closer to a 50-50 ratio you reach, the more money you make as a business.
Is there evidence for that? Is that a proven fact?
Yeah, there's tons of reports, McKinsey reports and other, you know, big four reports showing that diversity in business is a good thing. You know, it's women on boards, it's women in leadership, it's not just women, but it's people of colour, it's people with disabilities, it's all of these things. When you have a mixture of that at the decision-making table, your business creates more revenue. And well, that's what, when you look at really big businesses. And so why wouldn't you apply that to everything? And, you know, I think you can think of revenue in lots of ways, but what about if you think of it as social currency, you know, as the thing that the thing that holds our country and our communities and our villages together? That's valuable too, and that's the benefit that you'd get if you brought everybody to the table. And, you know, I think there are just so many opportunities if you listen to all the diverse voices in any organisation and in any business structure, whether it's for profit or whether it's for good. And golf just doesn't really make much of an effort to do that, in my experience. I was walking through a very prestigious club after pennant yesterday, and, you know, it always fascinates me when you see the board and it says, you know, like club champion with the blokes' names, and then it says women's club champion. And I'm just like, yeah, you know, it's like AFL, which is the men's version, and AFLW. And, you know, when they were the absolute outroar that, you know, that it caused when they, you know, they wanted to transition from an AFL to an AFLM game, you know, that we actually, you know, it's just completely unnecessary, and it doesn't detract from anything. In fact, it adds. But there's a lot of work to do in that space, I think, to acknowledge that different opinions make for a better place, not a more complicated place.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you're right, and people broadly would sort of get that, this notion that the default is always the men's version and that the women's is some sort of a different version. Golf, but maybe less so in terms of tournaments and those kinds of things, if you want to think about it that way. But golf on a week-to-week basis at a club level, the handicap system, golf's great. I think you've said it's both its great detriment and one of its greatest strengths is the handicap system. Actually, it doesn't need to be like that at all, is it? It's one of the few sports where you don't need to delineate in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't need a gender.
No.
It doesn't need a gender agenda. You know, I think that and that's one of the things I think is extraordinary about the game, is that you actually don't have to have anywhere near as much skill as the people you're playing with to, one, enjoy it, and two, to win. And that's the thing that I love, is that, I mean, don't get me wrong, it hasn't happened.
I was going to say, you'll love it when it happens.
Right at the very bottom of the winners list, which is where the losers hang out. I've been finding myself there regularly in comp, but I've been giving it a go.
And there's hope, Hannah. There's hope. Oh, that's the great thing about golf. There is hope.
Correct. At some point, I'm going to absolutely kill it, and everyone's going to be like, look at her go. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I'm going to have 45 points off 36, but
45 points, Hannah.
Exactly. But it's possible, right? And so, and the gender thing doesn't have to come into it. And it, you know, what's nice is, you know, we're playing and members now at a club. Sammy's been a member there for a long time, but where you can play off any tee with anybody, and you're encouraged mostly to do that. And so, yeah, you can all play together, you know, men and women together, be, you know, have an opportunity to enjoy the game and just have a bit of a laugh about it, still be able to have a competition, and it to be a really, really good experience. And there are just very few games like that. You know, there's another game called Korfball, which is a sport that originated out of the Netherlands. So, play. Do you know anything about Korfball?
I don't. Only what you mentioned on Karen Harding's Tee for Two podcast.
Yeah, wicker basket on the top of a post, very high, played at its highest level, men and women, only played with equal numbers of men and women at the highest level. And so, you know, golf's another one of these amazing games. But, you know, the challenge around the gender thing is that we haven't managed to yet, golf hasn't yet managed to iron out the growing narrative around including people who don't have a binary gender. And that's also, for me, that I find that a massive issue, because I think everybody should be welcome to all games. And so if you identify as non-binary, we still are struggling to find a way to manage that, at least at the competition level. I think what's nice is that anyone can come out and on any given day and play off any tee, but from a competition perspective, we still have challenges around what that looks like. And I'm not the person to resolve that. We need to get the people whose voices should be represented, those non-binary or gender fluid individuals, come to the table to help us make decisions around what that should look like for golf. But it should be a possibility. It needs to be something that we can address. And because we have a handicapping system. We should be able to do it, and we should be able to technically be a really, really inclusive all-gender sport. I think there are amazing opportunities for golf should it decide it wants to embrace that.
Forget about gender. It's a skill-based game, isn't it? That is,
yeah.
And it would be madness for you and your wife to play off the same set of tees, because she is at a completely – as mad as it would be for me and Rory to play off the same set of tees. That doesn't make any sense. So playing to sort of the level you want. In some ways in Australia, I think part of the problem is we take competition so seriously, golf competition in Australia, and the madness of that is you're playing for golf balls and what, ego? It's absurd. In some ways, it kind of ruins the game. I know people who won't play golf if it's not in a competition. That's a culture that's been ingrained in them somehow from somewhere.
I'm the opposite. I feel like at this point I don't want to play golf in a competition because I just don't want anyone to see what's going on behind the scenes. But, yeah, even the competition around bragging rights, you know, as a complete aside, my brother once won a hair growing competition for bragging rights, right? Like, Australians take, and he looked ridiculous.
I was going to say, what did you win? It looked like
nothing, just bragging rights. That's what the outcome of this hair growing competition was for. And but we'll take that, right? You know, and I think, what are you playing? You know, but everybody always, the comp's on and everyone still has a wager on the side, right? There's always something in it for everyone. Like, some people have had a wager on the side every year for 40 years, I think. But that's kind of, it is kind of nice about it too, that you can go out and you can not take yourself too seriously, but some people take themselves very seriously. But, yeah, we are immensely competitive. And so there is that element of, well, how would we win? Like, how do we work out who wins? And I think that isn't almost, it's not always the most important question. I think, you know, maybe the question around winning should be, how do we know when golf's won? You know, what is diversity and inclusion and equity in the game look like? So golf's the winner, not just that there's an individual winner at the end of the day, but the game's better for it. Everybody in the game's better for it. You know, I think those are questions we're not asking ourselves. You know, I think even by we created a competition within golf. We created another competitive league, right? It's playing against itself. I mean, maybe now it's all coming back together and the competition's destroyed, but I'm not sure any of us actually probably believe that. But even where there wasn't competition needed to be had, we found a way to make one.
You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker? At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf lowest price guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
John Huggan, who's a Scottish golf writer, he's been a guest on the program as well. And he said in that interview when we spoke, he said, it's too strong a way to put it, but love the game, hate the people. Does that resonate with you?
Yep. I wish it didn't, actually, but it really does. It not specifically hate the people, but hate the culture.
It's too strong a way to put it, as he said, but it makes the point, doesn't it? It's the game itself. I want you to talk about what the appeals of the game are.
It's that element of insanity, I think. It's the fact that, I mean, when I first started, I honestly could not believe why anyone would become a member of a club, because why on earth would you do the same thing every single week?
And pay handsomely for the privilege.
Yeah, right. Look, here's all my money.
Yeah.
Can I please do the same thing every week for the rest of my life? And I was like, why would anyone do that? What a ridiculous waste of money. And then I realised it's never the same every week. You know, the wind's different, the rain's different, and there's different work stuff in your head. You know, every single thing about the game is different. And I can attest to the fact that I've literally never seen the same part of the course twice. And I see a lot of the course.
You've seen most of the golf course.
I am getting my money's worth. Everybody says, how did you go? And I said, you know what? I got a lot of hits in. I feel like I'm really getting good value for money. And it's that. It's the fact that it is always different, and that you can spend a bunch of time hanging out with your friends, and it's the stories, and it's the fact that pretty much on basically every golf course I've been on lately, you walk off the first tee and you feel like you're a million miles away from work and the houses that are around the building. And, you know, I should really point out that that is an immense privilege. I mean, the privilege is that our the owners, the traditional owners of this land, that's a conversation maybe we'll say for another day, but we, you know, we do need to pay our respects and acknowledge that Australia's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are the traditional owners of this land. And
golf included.
And we, correct, and we get the privilege of playing on it. But it's that, it's the fact that you're a long way away from everything when you walk onto the golf course, and you it's also so good for you. Like, it's such a great day out. You get tons, if you're walking, you get tons of steps in. Your heart's beating, mine beats very hard, particularly if there's a chance that I will make a par putt. It's not so much like my heart's beating fast as it is like I may feel like I'm having a heart attack. And I can confidently say I cannot put that in the hole for par ever, even if I get a look at it, because I'm so nervous and I've already overthought it. But it's all of the things that make the – and the people do make it great also. It's not – all the people aren't bad. And so, you know, it's not so much about hate the people as it is hate the culture. You know, I think it's got – there are lots of things about it that are just immensely unhealthy. You know, it is that exclusivity. It is the rules. You know, I think that there are loads of rules for rules' sake. And I think that's – there's a lot of places where that's the case. But, you know, like hoodies and black socks, like are we really policing what people wear because it's, you know, out of a sign of what? History or respect or tradition? You know, I think...
Nicely dressed people can't be bad people, Hannah. Didn't you know that?
Yeah. You know, but it's that, right? You know, it is. It's all about perception. And you can't cover up bad culture and bad attitude with polo shirts. Like, a collar doesn't cover up the fact that you're being a bit of a
dick.
Jerk.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, it's, you know, like, am I going to be a better person on the course because I'm wearing white socks? Wouldn't have thought so.
No. White socks that I had to buy in the pro shop because the ones that I wore weren't acceptable.
Yeah, they had stripes on them.
That's right.
I mean, you know, there are, as someone who has a large number of tattoos, I acknowledge that there are still places where exposed tattoos aren't appropriate. And I just think with the number of people who have their eyebrows tattooed on these days, it feels a bit discriminatory to those who've decided to stick with my natural eyebrows but embrace a bit of body art elsewhere. But, you know, it does mean that there are lots of places where I still need to wear, for example, a long sleeve shirt all the time. And that's okay. But also, is it really necessary? You know, is that where we still are in society? And is that the kind of tradition we want to hold on to?
No, you're absolutely right. It's to come back to Sandy. Sandy always has great answers for these things, and his answer about the dress regulations is pretty simple. So go and stand outside the shopping mall and tell all the people who wouldn't be allowed on your golf course with what they're wearing that they can't go into the shops.
Yeah.
Watch the numbers pile up. And from a simple business perspective, that makes no sense. It's madness, isn't it, to just exclude people from the game based on sort of how they're dressed. I do feel that we've come a long way with that. And we're not all the way there by any stretch, but there were mad stories in the 80s and 90s of really crazy things happening. And part of that's been forced by, to come back to the business, prior to the pandemic, golf was in trouble. Golf clubs that had never been hurting before for members or financially were starting to hurt. And those things genuinely drive change, don't they? Sometimes they're the only thing that will drive change, the only motivation. Clubs are a weird business, aren't they? You've got membership that wants to pay as little as possible to get as much as possible, and the demands they put on the club to subsidise their membership fees can be quite extraordinary. One of the worst jobs in the world would be managing a golf club, I'm sure of it. The only thing worse would be being the captain of the golf club because you don't even get paid for that.
and you just have to listen to everyone about who hasn't put the bunker rake back in the right place on the third. Yeah, you know, but it's interesting, right? You know, I don't know. I haven't looked across the board, at, you know, and it's not publicly available mostly, about how much golf memberships have gone up in the last 12 months. But I would probably guess that they haven't gone up at a rate which matches inflation. And I think that means that the bubble's going to burst again pretty soon, right, because going to really struggle to to afford to run a golf club. You know, the cost of living is much higher. The cost, you know, there's increased superannuation. We're paying increased superannuation. The cost of electricity is going up in South Australia, Western Australia, and across the eastern seaboard. It's going to be more expensive to run a golf club. And so if the memberships haven't gone up to cover enough of that off, which would probably make the members pretty cross, one would have thought, because that's a big number, you know, we're going to see these clubs back in financial trouble. And if they had a more diverse business model, you know, a model where, I mean, I would love if I could have just had a, you know, maybe not in my, you know, where I'm a bit more committed to the game these days and I do want to play a bit more often, but, you know, an afternoon membership where I could have just gone out in summer and played nine holes and still committed to the club and still been part of something, but in a way that works better for me as a woman who runs a big business, who is very busy, who doesn't, you know, I'm probably never going to be able to play on a Tuesday morning in the women's comp because I just, as a 40-year-old woman running a big business, I can't get away from work. Not because I don't want to and not because I can't plan well, but because it's just not appropriate. And so, you know, memberships, you could run a far more diverse business model where you made memberships work for the current society as opposed to these sort of quite historical styles of membership.
A couple of things there. We haven't even told people, what did you? You're an extraordinarily accomplished and accredited and successful scientist in specialising in heart health. You mentioned the good things that playing golf does for your heart, and you're a pretty high-ranking person in the South Australian health system, I think, these days. Is that right?
Well, South Australian government, but not health, surprisingly. Yeah, I've made a transition back to my roots. So when I trained as a scientist, I spent about half my time in the health space and half my time in the agricultural space. So I was always very interested I've got a PhD in reproductive medicine, but it turns out that not just humans reproduce. We have challenges across the board with production. And one of the challenges that we face in Australia is with the production of cattle.
Right.
Heat stress, the impacts of climate, things like heat and lactation stress around dairy cattle, big problem for us because we like meat and we drink a lot of milk here in Australia. And so I spent about half my day sort of straddled on the fence between both of those things. So these days I have a science and innovation role at a government agency that looks after agricultural research for South Australia, primary industries research. So a big proportion of our economy is driven by primary industries here in South Australia. And I help to look after what that looks like.
Make sure they stay, so sort of in health in a way, making sure those areas stay healthy. I thought you were still in health, so that's my mistake. You were pretty high up in health when you were over in Victoria.
I was.
One of the reasons I bring that up, during lockdown for a bit of sport, you did a Masters of Business Administration. As you would. Took up golf and did a Masters of Business Administration. And for your final assignment, rather than focus on science, I think you said, you wanted to do something different. So you did something about golf. Tell us about that study and what you learnt from that and what golf might more broadly learn from that. We talk about golf as though it's something that you can sort of move around. It's just a whole bunch of different individual clubs and whatnot. But what golf and those in golf should be thinking about in terms of the way the game looks and the way a game perhaps could be improved if it looked differently.
Yeah, so you're right. I spent a lot of time focusing on science during my MBA because obviously those things are front of mind. But golf was kind of becoming front of mind in that same period, and I was learning that for every one step I took towards something I really loved about it, I found something that just was endlessly frustrating. And so I did think about how to put a diversity lens across the game of golf to improve its business model. You know, I thought, we see this in other businesses. People are thinking differently about what this looks like. Where are the strengths and opportunities for golf as a game? And what could that look like for a business model here in Australia? And it wasn't, you know, there was nothing about it that was rocket science, I don't think, but it was taking the learnings from the Big Bash, you know, in cricket, and the big changes that we've seen from a addition to the AFLW game for AFL, the addition of women to that game, and seeing what the benefits of what have happened there and what that could look like for golf. And, you know, it was about one of the things that I identified that was, you know, that's really missing is that sort of grassroots transition in golf. You know, if you do you know, if you do, you know, grassroots, little kids play, there are lots of options for grassroots footy at very low cost for kids. What does that look like for golf, and what could that look like so that you actually, you know, who could you partner with as a tier one club to ensure that you've got a sustainable line of members coming from wherever you are? Could you partner with a public course? Could you financially support that course to ensure it stays, but in, you know, in doing so, ensure your system, mm-hmm. your financial sustainability by, you know, always having a stream of members ready to enter the club? You know, it was about, you know, that was just one element, but, you know, I also looked at the position that was kind of missing from a reconciliation perspective and a commitment to Australia's First Nations peoples and their ownership of the land and where we are really missing the mark with respect to golf. I think there are still probably many clubs that don't acknowledge the country that they're on a regular basis. I'm delighted to be at a club that takes that seriously, where, you know, an acknowledgement opens the AGM. But we, you know, these clubs are profiting from land which isn't theirs, you know, not unlike lots of other businesses, but it is a really big piece of land and a really big responsibility. And so a number of these things, you know, a number of those things. Also just making it a safe and inclusive space for people who have not yet been welcomed to the game, for non-binary people, for this, you know, to amend this gender piece, but also for culturally and linguistically diverse people. You know, I think for, you know, for refugees and migrants to Australia, for people looking for an opportunity, public golf, you know, the Oakley public golf opportunity is a brilliant one. Anyone can go down there. They could borrow a one club from Sandy, and for a small amount of money, they could all jump on the course. And actually, you could jump on with Sandy. Yeah. He would take you around and introduce you to the game. And where is that? Where is that? Where is that pipeline for introducing new people to the game, introducing different people to the game, for growing the game? You know, I think this term growing the game exists a lot. We use it a lot. But, you know, I think, is it growing, or is it just perpetuating more of the same?
It's code for grow my business generally. When you hear that, you're normally hearing it from somebody who's really trying to say, well, grow my business is what that generally means. If you look at if you remember at a golf club and you look at your local community and the makeup of it in terms of diversity and culture and race and languages and those things, and then you look at your golf club in most parts of Australia, they won't match, will they, Hannah?
No, golf is absolutely not representative of the general population, you know, not from a socioeconomic perspective, not from a gender perspective, not from a cultural perspective. I think it looks like the top echelon of society, really, and it that's an issue, you know, and it's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about, and it's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about what my role is to resolve some of those things. You know, in my current member, I'm a brand new member, and in my current membership status, I'm not yet allowed to sit on a committee, but I look forward to the time when I can. You know, I realise that if I want to enjoy this thing, that with that comes responsibility in it. And my perspective on what that responsibility looks like is to create a path for people like me, like a, you know, a woman in a same-sex marriage that started the golf game when she was in her late 30s, but for people who don't look like me too, you know, for people who perhaps weren't born in Australia, for people who perhaps weren't born into privilege like I was, for people who deserve to get to enjoy the game. You know, I don't think that there should be limits and barriers to allow people to enjoy the game, and there kind of is at the moment. You know, even if you can pick up some secondhand golf clubs, which it's much harder to do these days because everybody took up golf in the pandemic, but maybe people will be selling them on at some point. But it's still hard, you know, and you need a lot of gear for golf, right? For it to include 20 odd people in a game of cricket or soccer in the park, you don't need very much gear. You know, soccer, you need something that can represent nets, and that might just be a couple of jumpers at each end and a ball. You need a lot more for golf. And so, well, I mean, Sandy would argue you don't. Maybe you just need one club. And, you know, I think that that's proof that you can change the way people think about the game and that you can make it inclusive. And I think what he's done is extraordinary. If anyone isn't familiar with it, which they absolutely should be,
yes.
you know, Sandy's doing amazing things to encourage all ability instructors to join the game, to bring people who are not necessarily golf experts towards the game, to encourage others to come towards the game. And I think that's what genuine inclusion looks like. You know, it's not about only allowing people who are extraordinary at golf to train people to be extraordinary at golf, but to bring people around the game who love the game.
The truth about most people is we're not going to get extraordinary at the game, no matter who it is that's teaching us. That's the reality of golf. There's a very small percentage of the population who have whatever those genes are that can make you, right from your wife right up to the, you know, the best players in the world. They're a minority, and they always will be, because the game just is – it's a – well, as Sandy puts it, it's a difficult game to play well, but it's a really easy game to play, and he's right about
that. Yeah,
soccer's interesting, isn't it? They often call it the world game. Its greatest advantage is you don't need anything but the ball, and 50 people can get involved in that one game with one ball. That works against golf in many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a public space. Yeah. You know, I think that's the other thing about golf, and that's where – if public golf and if golf in general doesn't make a strong case for its viability, that it won't be viable, right? You know, I think there are these big public spaces that councils and others are asking, well, who and why are we paying for this? You know, is this a public space? Can everybody enjoy this space? There's an easy argument to resolve this, right? Help create a version of the game that everyone can be part of, that, you know, that everybody can enjoy at reasonably low cost, where there are very few barriers to entry, and make a strong argument for why it should exist, why public golf courses should still be there. Because, you know, yeah, there are times where it's super cheap, where you're going to, you know, where you can borrow a set of clubs, where there'll be someone out there helping walk people through the game. And if you invest in that version of it, then actually you'll create a model, you know, a very long-term sustainable model. As people get hooked, because we all know it is like a cult, and you totally get hooked, even if you think that you absolutely won't like me.
It's funny. Well, some people don't. They're not everybody's wired to be a golfer. I think your curiosity and your mix of both art and science interests probably really works in favour of golf appealing, because golf appeals to each of those equally. I've introduced people to the game who will never go on to play, and I've introduced other people to the game who have got more of a sickness than I have. So there's only two types of people in the world, Hannah. There's golfers and non-golfers. And not everyone who plays golf is a golfer, and not everyone who doesn't play is a non-golfer. It's an interesting sort of way of being. The other thing about public golf, of course, Hannah, is if we don't make it proactively inclusive and diverse – it works against any argument you might make when the forces of non-golf come for the course. If you're not doing those things, you're a much easier target, much less likely to be able to save the golf course. And that is happening. Golf, we are losing public golf courses, and that is, once they've gone, we know they never come back.
Yeah, I mean, they're becoming, you know, they'll become a much smaller shared space and housing, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's
eventually,
and the longer the game decides it wants to be highly exclusive, and the longer there are not pipelines to transition people from public golf to private golf or something that maybe is halfway in between, I don't know. I think the model, we really need to assess what that model looks like long term. Public golf's going to be gone. And when public golf's gone, you know,
the clock's ticking on golf.
Yeah, 100%. Because if you don't have a bunch of, you know, the average punter will struggle to get onto a private course, and it is very expensive mostly. And so where will they learn to play, and where will they feel comfortable learning to play? Because I can tell you that one of the things that I find most difficult, not because where I'm at is not supportive, because I, you know, we are lucky to be at a club that is hugely supportive, still has some of the cultural challenges around golf, but has a really strong female membership that is very forward thinking in its approach to diversity, equity and inclusion and a range of other things. But I still feel uncomfortable in the comp. You know, I'm slow because it takes me, like, I have to swing my arms about 50 more times than everyone else. And so I do still feel the pressure of being around a private club because I'm not very good. No one else applies it. Mostly it's me. But, you know, it's that kind of responsibility to keep up. And if that's the only option for people joining the game, how do you create an environment that actually supports that, it's very difficult.
Almost nobody is introduced to the game by seeing it on TV, deciding they want to have a go at it, and going down to the local private golf course and signing up for a membership. It would be madness. Nobody would take the game up that way. Go and buy a new set of clubs and sign up for it. It makes no sense from anybody's point of view. So without public golf, you just don't have private golf. It's pretty simple.
Exactly. And, you know, and I think you can't even do that in most places at the moment. No. There's lots of waiting lists. And so, yeah, you go and thoroughly enjoy a game with your mates at the work golf day and you think, yeah, I've got this. I'm going to give this a crack. And then you go and you sit on a waiting list for 5 years. And in that time, you've like had a kid and bought a house. You can't afford to play golf and that's it. Your interest is over and maybe you'll come back as a person whose kids have finished uni and you're no longer paying for them, but probably you won't. You know, there'll be a lot of things that happen in that transition time. And yeah, just, but I think there are a huge amount of opportunities. That's the thing I love, is that with a bit of creative thinking that actually, and a bit of buy-in, right? You know, I think if it's not something that everybody or that the vast majority want, it's going to be really hard to get it across the line. But it is possible, you know, and I think maybe we will see some kind of cultural shift because we'll have to.
Does that make it generational by default, Hannah? Is it going to be generational change? I've often felt that golf clubs reflect something about society, which is, and I'm not sure what it is, but slower to change than most other parts, perhaps because it's the club environment. So you kind of don't. Otherwise perfectly sensible and intelligent blokes in their middle ages who work in senior management behave one way at the office and a completely different way at the golf club, partly because it's allowed, I think. So it reflects something about it. Generationally, that will change, but is that too slow?
Look, it's probably faster than in many other industries that are struggling to create real change. You know, I think if – take engineering, for example, I think – the number of women as engineering graduates right now is very low, right? It's less than 25, but I think it's actually probably more like 15% of the people going through engineering degrees are women. And so you can't get to a 50% female workforce in engineering by only having that many people go through the pipeline. And so, you know, they're approaching change at a whole range of places, but to actually create the change that's required to get from, you know, increasing the number of young girls interested in science all the way through to seeing them through a safe and comfortable and a good experienced engineering degree and then into a male-dominated workforce. That's a long time, right? We're talking about many decades. In golf, it doesn't have to be that long. You know, I think it's nice to see, you know, these days on LinkedIn, I see young people as captains and presidents of clubs more frequently. There are definitely more women. And so the times are changing. I think it's always hard for that first person, you know, the first young captain or the first female captain or these people, they struggle to make the change that's required because all the eyes are on them. Probably wrongly so, but, you know, that person's always a target for everybody's feelings. But I think the second person in the line, you know, that next person that's getting up to do it behind them because they've seen that other person succeed, they're the person that's going to be capable of making more change. And so it's probably not generational, but it's not fast. You know, we're not going to see everybody wake up tomorrow and be like, oh my God, we need a fixed golf. Let's, you know, not fix, just modify. Because fundamentally, there's nothing really wrong with the game. The game's excellent, but it has opportunities. We're not going to see people like, yeah, let's take all of those. But I think we will see change happen more quickly. And I think we'll also see, you know, there'll be the financial pressure, but there'll be that fear of missing out pressure too, you know, that marketing piece where a couple of clubs really stand up and they really stand out from the crowd. They're open to putting their head up above it, not scared of getting their head chopped. And all of a sudden it will create that marketing pressure where everybody has to step up and follow. You know, it'll be the first club that, you know, works out how to incorporate, you know, make a safe space for non-binary people. Mm-hmm. The first, you know, completely carbon neutral golf club. The first, you know, it's going to be these groups that stand up with people that are courageous, and then all of a sudden the change is going to happen. And that's what we see in all kinds of, you know, in all kinds of marketing theory. Look at things like the iPhone, right? There's every time a new iPhone comes out, there's a bunch of people that get in line to buy one. And those first people that buy one, those people waiting in line, they don't necessarily care about the iPhone. They don't really understand the technology, but they're early adopters, and they're going to have one because there's a new iPhone.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of people right behind them from a marketing theory perspective that they're the people willing to take the change. You know, they know the technology, they know the benefit it's going to add. And it's when you get to, you know, then you get to about 13 to 18% of the population, then you get this big shift. You get all of the people having to go all in because you've reached that tipping point. And so it's probably getting to that 13 to 18% of clubs. And I honestly don't think it take that much. No. You know, a few leaders that are doing some stuff that are really attractive, gets a lot of positive press, gets featured, all of a sudden it's going to go. And I think, you know, right at the beginning, we talked a bit about whose responsibility it is and who us is or who we is. The media can play a really important role. Golf media can play a really important role there. The next time you see a woman leading a golf club doing something amazing, everyone can jump on it and showcase it. When you see clubs that are doing things that are really transitional, that are really complementary for a range of reasons, you get on and publicize those things and you focus on the really good in the game. And then all of a sudden you are creating a narrative around change and sort of forcing the hand. Maybe because I've said this, it won't work because everyone will say, oh, Hannah said we'd all be suckers and we'd all get fear of missing out and we'd all roll in, but it will happen. We'll see change. It won't be as it probably, you know, maybe it will take 20 years for some real change to happen, but actually that's much faster than we see change happen around other things. So I think that's still promising.
You've touched on a whole bunch of stuff and there's hours to talk, but we won't do that. I've banged on almost relentlessly about golf's image problem. As a recent non-golfer leaning towards anti-golfer, cast your mind back to there. What do we, as golf, again, this amorphous mass, get wrong? I feel like in Australia and parts of the UK and America, we've actually we've put off people. People have a negative image of the game. You don't see that in Scotland where St Andrews is in the middle of the town. If you want to walk across the golf course, you just do. But that's not the case so much. People who don't play golf generally will be – indifferent would be nice if we could get to that, but you said you've got a lot of people who are anti-golf. How have we managed to do that? How do we change that, Hannah?
Well, I mean, we certainly change it by showing that golf looks different to the way it actually people perceive it looks. You know, I think, and that's I think one of my learnings is that I didn't really know what it looked like, but media, you know, popular media and television and, you know, and all of the, you know, popular culture told me to expect that it was one particular way, and I kind of just made the assumption that it was. And I mean, for all intents and purposes, it still is a lot like that. It still is the place where
it's not hard to find the stereotypes, is it? The middle-aged rich white blokes are very much involved in golf, and lots of them at certain places.
Yeah, and you know, it is still, people are still doing business deals on the golf course. You know, I think people joke historically about the fact that that's where business deals have got done. And, you know, and I joke to people about that a bit often, actually, about, you know, my sort of rise to business leadership and the fact that I got it all done on the golf course. But that's why I was trying to improve my game so that I could get in and around those people. And actually, fundamentally, I can't imagine anything worse than having a round of that kind of golf. But I think, you know, it's the... If you only show things in a certain, you know, if it's considered only appropriate to only show things in a certain light, you know, if this is what golf looks like, if golf looks like, you know, polished polo shirts and white socks and long pants and, you know, all of these kind of, they're stereotypes, but they're still real mostly, then that's what people expect it looks like. You know, if they're not given a window into a game that looks like a bunch of women drinking a gin and tonic and laughing their asses off around the course, which they're never shown, right?
No.
We don't see that.
No.
Then people are not going to make assumptions in their head about how great they think the game is. You know, people are not going to waste their time thinking, I wonder if that's a game for me, when all they see is people that don't look like them. And so if you want to, you know, it's not different to any other trajectory to anything. You know, you think about a woman's trajectory to business leadership. you can only be what you can see, mm-hmm. right? Like you can't, you know, and I spend a lot of time thinking about what this looks like in, you know, STEM has the same issues that golf has. It's male dominated. It's working hard, but it's got a long way to go. We lose a lot of women at a time when they start families and they become less competitive than their peers. And so men get more funding and more grants and win more awards while women are off raising families. And then they find it hard to get back. And, you know, it's not super different than golf. Like how many young women raising families have time to just ditch their kids somewhere while they go and spend 6 hours hanging out with their mates on the golf course? Not that many.
It even happens to blokes in this day and age, Hannah, which is one of the issues
Does
golf
it?
Clubs have seen with memberships, is that there's a whole cohort at a certain point in life. They've got responsibilities at home and at work that they can't fit their golf in anymore.
And yet we don't see heaps of blokes fighting for childcare within golf places so that everyone can be part of it. Because fundamentally, if you design solutions that work for the most vulnerable in society, they work for everybody. Health, policy, whatever, same situation applies. So imagine if men in the game were championing for something that worked for them but actually worked for other people.
For everybody.
You know, it's just not that hard, but it just can't be women fixing all the problems. You know, we already get, you know, women in leadership, and that's what you get in golf clubs too. Like you look at the people, the women that are in leadership positions at golf clubs these days, mostly very successful business women, already overburdened, already sitting on a bunch of boards because there are less women at that level. So they're overcommitted. They're asked to do more. They're busting their asses. And yet, you know what? Nothing is that hard that it couldn't be resolved by blokes. And fundamentally, they could sit down, ask the women what they want and need, and instead of just going and thinking they know what the right answer is, they could just deliver the solutions that women have identified will work and then just get on with it. But I think, you know, I think the only people to blame if blokes are saying, I can't get time for golf because I don't have anyone to look after my kids, is the fact that they haven't come up with a solution that works for them that looks like childcare for golf. Like, it's just not that hard. But instead, we haven't got to that point. But we could, because you know what? Why couldn't you have childcare at a golf?
Well, we've been to the moon.
Well,
so, this is often my job. Oh, we couldn't do that. We've never done it. That was like, well, we went to the moon. It can't be that hard, you know.
Make a kind of publicly accessible golf on the weekends where you can take your kids, where you can play in a round that's mixed, where you can play and they can play, and you know, maybe have a coach join you so that you play two kids and two amazing parents, and you all go out and do it together. There are heaps of solutions. Just, you know, or play nine holes. Like make it an okay thing to do to play nine holes or six holes or however many you can fit that fits within your life. It doesn't have to be a 6 hour journey. I mean, don't get me wrong, I quite like 6 hours of quiet and I quite like being out there for 6 hours when the weather's good too. But heaps of solutions, none of them hard, none of them super expensive.
And none of them are either or, are they? You can still have your 6 hours while I take my 2 hours and then I can go and you can remain for the other 4 hours. But it's had no impact on you. One of the great joys of golf, isn't it, is that there's no lines. It's not like tennis or football. There's no in or out. It's played on this magnificent landscape where you're free to choose how you get from point A to point B, and yet we insist on trying to put all these limitations around it in every way, from the simplicity of it's got to have four par fives and four par threes and that kind of stupidity about golf courses, right down to some of the things you're doing. Well, you couldn't possibly have childcare at the golf club because we never have had before, and it would introduce an insurance issue and all of this other stuff. You know, one of the great joys is you can go and play with your kids and grandparents. You can have four generations if you wanted to, all making up a group of golfers. But we kind of get into this culture of golf where suddenly that's no longer an option, and it's madness. You're right. There's no reason that golf can't change and be different.
I would be delighted if someone said, oh, I'm only playing nine holes today, so do you want my second nine? Like, yes, I do. Like, you know, my arms get tired because, you know, still completely rubbish. But those are totally options, but they're not quite right. You know, on a comp day,
it'd affect your handicap, Hannah. How would you possibly? How could you have a handicap system that?
How would my handicap get better or worse?
Yeah, that's
exactly. And like, who cares? I don't actually, you know, I definitely am paying less attention to that thing than I used to because it's not getting. I'm not playing enough golf actually for it to get any better. It's getting worse at the moment. But you know, who cares? But those so many options, right? None of those things are. You said people we've been to the moon, like. Much exactly. easier than that.
Yeah.
Much easier. And a solution that works for everybody.
Yeah. That's exactly. Well, it's like the dress thing, isn't it? The way I dress has no bearing on how much you enjoy your day. I'm never going to wear a hoodie and a pair of shorts and black socks, but I don't care if you do. Because it has no bearing on me. I've never been able to understand that notion that it's just either either or, you know. It doesn't sort of make
– Yeah, or it's bad for the game. Like – Oh, it's bad for the game. I'm like, what's bad for the game? Like,
What is the game? Here's the other thing. What is the game? The game is a collection of people who enjoy a particular recreation, and the Venn diagram for most things in golf overlaps pretty strongly. There's little stuff around the fringes that there might be sort of disagreement, but most people share this game for the same reasons. All those things that you articulated earlier about.
Yeah.
Out there spending time in the fresh air and all of those sorts of things. Yeah. You know? Some would add competition to it. Some like you. Mike Clayton spent his life as a professional golfer. Couldn't care less about a scorecard anymore. Doesn't play that sort of
thing. Same as Sandy, right?
Same like, Sandy. Doesn't care.
Talk about someone someone who's performed at the highest level as a coach and is out there in jeans and a hoodie every day, absolutely killing it. Does it make him less of a coach? Nah. It makes him accessible and it allows him to connect with people who don't understand, you know, the people that he's trying to connect with, people who don't necessarily understand the rules of the game that exist for no particular reason. Like, yeah, you know, there are reasons to wear uniform if it's for safety, right? Like if one person had ever told me that wearing a collar meant you got less exposure to the sun and you were less likely to get a skin cancer, which is, I think, the only justification.
Is it true?
No,
I didn't think it was that's true. But if it was.
No, I've never heard anyone say it, right? Skin cancer's rife in the golf game. And if a single person, I mean, it would make sense to force everyone to wear a long sleeve t-shirt as opposed to something with a, you know, something, well, they make a lot of people wear pants. But, rather than wearing a collar, they would tell you to wear long sleeves if that was what it was about. But it's totally not about that. But they haven't even picked up that that's what they could say. Oh, it's for skin cancer.
Yeah, that's right.
It's it's not.
Collars are some sort of long-standing socioeconomic hierarchy thing, are they not? Those who wore collars were of
We use them to define those, define that status, you know, white collar, blue collar.
Yeah, that's very
true. You know, it's about the colour of your collar, you know.
Yeah, very true. I'm going to bring this all the way around to close it off, Hannah, and we're going to finish with this. So after all of that and the discussion we've had, which has been a disorganized shambles of interesting points that I think have been raised, what's the thing about golf for Hannah Brown?
Oh, I think the thing is that it really is a game that you can pick up at any time in your life and give it a go, at any point in your life for anybody, should the right situation and the right environment exist for you. You know, I don't, if I hadn't met Sam, I'm not sure whether the right time or the right situation or environment ever would have arisen for me, despite the fact that I'd had a go 30 years before that day. But the thing about golf is that that's an option. You know, it is potentially a game for everybody on any given day if it does the work to get it right. Yeah.
If only it would allow it. So you've come full circle. I like that. So you are a prime example of a golfer who for most of your life didn't play golf, but you get it. Do you know what I mean? You were waiting for the game to find you. Often they say dogs find people. You know, you hear that. People are looking for a dog and suddenly a friend has a dog or a stray wanders into. I think golf's the same. It wanders into your life if you're a golfer at the appropriate time.
Yeah, and, if you're privileged enough,
absolutely,
it wanders into your life. And I think, wouldn't it be nice if it could just wander into anybody's life?
Yeah, that's a bigger question, isn't it? I wonder how – and golf's never gotten over that. How do you introduce people? You alluded to it earlier. You were kind of introduced to it by somebody who plays. I've often thought that golf – the responsibility of being a golfer is to introduce somebody else to the game, whether they go on with it or not. Because none of the grassroots programs and none of the junior golf programs and the initiatives to try and get more people playing golf don't really seem to work in a they do the hard work and they're effective, but not in significant kind of numbers. And I had an idea years ago, and if you tried to have it, you'd meet all sorts of resistance. But just a national bring a friend to golf day, where half the members of the golf club at that Saturday comp day don't play, and the other half bring a friend. Give them clubs.
And the next week you swap over.
That's right. Don't charge them. Play a scramble or an Ambrose event. Let them hit the ball and have a bit of fun. And you know, everyone's going to chip in at some point or hole a putt or get one out of the bunker. They're going to hit that shot. And if they're a golfer, they'll become a golfer from that moment. But I can guarantee you if you try – here I am building barriers before I even try. If you tried that, you get all sorts of resistance and pushback from all sorts of clubs and members. Oh, what's your – and people trying to bring their mates who are golfers but just think they can have a free game for the day at your club because they've got this promotion on. Those sorts of issues start to – but that, I think, would be the most effective way to actually grow the game. The best way to grow the game is to put clubs in people's hands and let them play.
Yeah, but the best way to get that done is to incentivise it, right? You know, I think what is the motivation for change? And it should be because clubs want to change, but if it's not, what's the next best thing? Well, and that is incentivisation. Yeah. And so, you know, if Golf Australia thought, you know what, this is something that we really want to change about the game and we're going to incentivise every club who participates in this, and for every new person that they introduce to the game, we're going to give them something, or we're going to support you to do something, or... there are ways, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And I think, you know, some of the other stuff's going to require incentivisation from Golf Australia and other senior bodies too, you know, around inclusion and around commitment to reconciliation, around a range of those other things. But it's all possible, you know, if there's enough goodwill and enough buy-in to create change, then all of those things are absolutely possible. I mean, you and I could write a letter to every president and captain of a golf club in the country and try and get them on board. A bunch of groups would say yes to us. And maybe we'd get to that 13% to 18% of groups, and maybe we'd create enough FOMO and say, look at what this facilitated for the game, and look what we think's possible if you create change. But I think there are enough champions for change in the game across Australia that
I do too.
You know, you and Sandy and others and Mike Clayton and lots of people who want the game to be as good as the game can be. If you got that kind of buy-in,
yeah,
I think you'd have it covered. And you know what? The Australian golfers that are getting about at the moment, there are enough of them that I think would put their money where their mouth is. You know, Cam Smith and Leash and a range of others. Hannah Green, who people, being Hannah Brown, it is a joy to accidentally be called Hannah Green on a weekly or so basis at the golf club. Oh, this is the new member, Hannah Green. And I'm just like,
that's right.
No, do a bit of a fist pump and get a very excited. But, you know, there's enough of those people that would genuinely champion for this because they're pretty normal people. You know, they're awesome. They could be amazing advocates for the game. So maybe there's a combined strategy that'll get it done.
Yeah, two things there. One, Hannah Green started exactly the same way you did, Hannah, just at a younger age.
Yeah, 45 she handicap. I promise you, she did.
She advanced much more quickly than you seem to be to this point. But she started in the same place and being embarrassed, you know, playing with the scratch markers at the club, and there weren't any other girls. In fact, she was almost lost to the game, except for a wonderful woman called Sue Thompson, founder at Mount Lawley, which is one of the things. The other thing is, if we don't find that incentivation within, some incentivation is going to come from outside of golf. We talk about public golf.
Yeah.
It will just be taken away by those who have won the argument wrongly that it's a waste of water, a waste of space, it's a waste of these things. You won't get a say and it will disappear. So if you don't do it from within, it's going to be forced from without, some of it. And that's not the best way to have it happen. So better to have some control and some say. Hannah Brown, it's been fabulous to chat to you. It always is. As I said, it's been a disorganised and rambling chat, but I've enjoyed all of it. I hope you have too. If anybody's still listening, I hope they have as well. But I must say thank you, and let you get back to your extremely important job there in South Australia. It's been wonderful to chat.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the discussion was a bit of a disorganised shambles, but for me it got the neurons firing, and I hope that it was the same for you. Big thanks to Dr. Hannah Brown for taking the time to chat with us. That's it for episode 96, but make sure to come back for episode 97 when John Huggins sits down with a man who may not be well known but has some fabulous stories to tell after a decades-long role at the Open.
The big eye-opener for me was 1982 and Bobby Clampett, and he was running away with it after 36 holes. He was involved inside the media centre, or the press centre as it was then, for 2 hours. He lost the Open there and then.
That's former Open Championship media director David Begg. Next time on The Thing About Golf.